we are not drilling offshore for oil. All of the oil development is from an onshore land rig.
A Texas company plans to drill for Cook Inlet oil from an onshore rig. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, dancing on a Chukchi Sea ice floe.
It would be the most amazing sound when you'd be in the, in the ship and you'd be going through ice and you'd hear cracking through the ice, and I love that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A Texas-based company will begin drilling for oil in Cook Inlet next year using extended-reach drill rigs. Blue Crest Energy plans to drill from shore about 6 miles north of Anchor Point. KBBI's Quinton Chandler reports.
Blue Crest held three meetings in the three communities closest to the proposed site, Ninilchik, Anchor Point, and Homer. Blue Crest plans to drill onshore wells, some as deep as 25,000 feet straight down and 2.5 miles out beneath the ocean floor to tap the reserves in the cosmopolitan fields.
We are not drilling offshore for oil. All of the oil development is from an onshore land rig.
Larry Burgess, the health, safety, and environmental manager for Blue Crest, says drilling from shore will leave very little risk of spills in the inlet. Although onshore drilling was far more welcome than the prospect of offshore wells, Anchor Point and Homer residents still had concerns.
Ken Lewandowski, I live in Cottonwood Subdivision, which is in the backyard, the side yard of the Starisky plant that they plan on building.
Lewandowski says there's only one road in and out of his subdivision where Blue Crest plans to drill. Lewandowski says living in that home was originally part of his retirement plan, but after learning about the Cosmopolitan project, he's looking for an exit strategy. He wants Blue Crest to compensate all four homeowners in the subdivision for the inconvenience.
You know, I spoke with this gentleman, Larry, a couple minutes ago, and he assured me that we're going to sit down again, and I'm looking forward to our next meeting.
Other big concerns during the meeting included fire danger, spill prevention, noise, water use, and mode of transportation. Burgess was prepared with an answer for nearly every issue, but no answer could stem worry over the risk of trucking oil. Burgess says there are only three real options to get the oil from the plant up to the Tesoro refinery in Nikiski: by truck, by ship, and by pipeline.
If we have one barge running up and down Cook Inlet once or twice a week, that's much less traffic with oil moving than if we're running four or five trucks a day. But on the other hand, we're looking at, around 400 barrels per truck as opposed to 50,000 barrels in a barge.
Blue Crest would rather risk the 400 barrels on the road. A pipeline was the most popular option at both meetings. It's the safest and most efficient mode of transport, but it's also expensive. Blue Crest plans to eventually produce about 17,000 barrels per day, and Burgess says that's nowhere near enough to justify a pipeline to Nikiski. Reporting from Anchor Point and Homer, I'm Quinton Chandler.
The International Maritime Organization's Marine Safety Committee, meeting in London this week, adopted 5 recommended areas to be avoided in the Aleutian chain. As KUCB's Emily Schwing reports, the shipping buffer zones come in anticipation of increased mariner shipping traffic in the region.
The new zones apply to ships 400 gross tons and heavier, the kind of ships that make transoceanic voyages through the Bering Sea and the North Pacific. Leslie Pearson is a project manager for the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment and a consultant. She says the zones are meant to dampen environmental damage in the event of an accident or spill.
Well, it's definitely the projection of, future development in Alaska and along the West Coast helped as far as being a driver for establishing these, but also past accidents. I mean, we learn from history that perhaps it's better to be further offshore than to be close to shore.
The zones come from recommendations made by the U.S. Coast Guard. They're based on similar areas to be avoided established around the northern Hawaiian islands. Those in the Aleutians extend 50 nautical miles from shore on islands at the tip of the Alaska Peninsula, as well as Unalaska, Unimak, Adak, Atka, Kiska, and Attu Islands. But there are also passages outlined in between each zone.
One of the things that probably wasn't taken into effect in Hawaii was when you get the winter storms, many of the mariners need to seek refuge in the Bering Straits, where you have calmer weather than what you would see in the Pacific Ocean. And that was the reason for keeping the passageways open, so that way mariners can use those as an option for storm avoidance.
In March, the International Maritime Organization approved the zones, but final approval falls to the IMO's Marine Safety Committee.
One of the things about going through the IMO process is it will actually put these areas to be avoided on charts, both international and domestic charts.
Even though the areas will show up on maps and charts, they are only voluntary.
Whether it's voluntary or mandatory, people tend to adhere to them, and insurance companies recognize these as well. So if an operator is deviating from something that's on the books, whether it's recommended or mandatory, they do take notice.
Under the IMO, the Coast Guard can still make the buffer zones mandatory. Once they're finally approved, NOAA has 6 months to add the areas to charts. In Unalaska, I'm Emily Schwing.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is investigating the deaths of several stellar sea lions southwest of Cordova. Julie Spiegel is a spokesperson for NOAA Fisheries Alaska Region. She says 15 dead sea lions were discovered in the area on June 1st.
3 to 5 of them had wounds that our biologists could definitely say were human-caused wounds. So that indicates that these stellar sea lions had been deliberately killed.
Killing sea lions violates the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which only allows limited exceptions for subsistence hunting by Alaska Natives. These particular animals were from the western stock of stellar sea lions, which are also listed under the Endangered Species Act. NOAA law enforcement is looking for information from anyone with details about the event and are offering an award up to $2,500 for information leading to a conviction. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Gloria Steinem visits Fairbanks after Ms. Magazine was nearly banned from a local store.
You know, we've had this issue, but not in a long time. I think this is maybe the first time in 20 years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The Alaska Fisheries Conservation Alliance has handed over enough signatures to the State Division of Elections to get a voter initiative on the 2016 general election ballot. The alliance wants to stop all commercial set netting in 5 areas deemed to be urban and non-subsistence under Alaska law, according to the group's president, Joe Connors, who owns a sport fishing lodge on the Kenai River. The alliance's motive is to conserve dwindling salmon stocks.
They've got these massive pieces of equipment that harvest a lot of fish quickly, and anybody else is either fishing with a dip net or fishing with a rod and reel, and they're not that efficient compared to a 210-foot net.
The initiative asks state voters to decide on banning set nets in the 5 urban areas. A state superior court decision last year favored the alliance's plan to put the question on the ballot, but the state has challenged that decision and asked the state's Supreme Court to decide if the alliance's initiative is legal. Corey Mills, a spokeswoman for the State Department of Law, says state attorneys are drafting an opinion on the constitutional legality of the initiative and would not comment further on the issue. The state Supreme Court will hear the case during August 26th and 27th. Smaller boats in Alaska's offshore fisheries may no longer have to carry human observers in the future if a plan to deploy cameras proves feasible. At its Sitka meeting this month, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council gave the green light to an interagency effort to develop electronic monitoring. The council would like to see cameras in action within 3 years. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Although the headline news out of the council's contentious June meeting focused on bycatch, there wouldn't even be a bycatch debate without human observers. Bycatch is what you get when you're trying to catch something else. Year-round, observers fly to Alaska's remote ports, board fishing boats, and go out on trips. They monitor the bycatch, sample the harvest, and collect the reams of data needed by organizations like the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to sustainably operate commercial fishing in the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska. On a big boat with a large crew, like a factory trawler, an extra person isn't necessarily a big deal. On small boats, that extra person can be a bit of a wild card.
When we had our observer on board, our observer was seasick for about half of the days. Conditions were cramped, and I got to sleep at the galley table.
This is Stephen Rhodes explaining to the council why he's one of over 100 boat owners who ask for exemptions when they're randomly selected to carry an observer.
The observing was not approaching anything I would call complete. It greatly disrupted our regular fishing functions.
This so-called observer effect is a concern. If fishing trips are miserable with an extra person on board, or if boats manipulate their normal fishing patterns in order to return to port sooner and shed their observers, how does it affect the quality of the data? Recently, the council authorized a research program to test electronic monitoring, and Rhodes was one of 11 boat owners to volunteer to have cameras installed on his deck.
Hi. Hey, George?
Yeah.
Yeah, Robert.
Another one of those volunteers was George Eliason. I visited him aboard his 50-foot longliner in Sitka's Crescent Harbor.
This wire here goes over to the hauler. Okay. As soon as the hauler turns on, it starts the cameras up. Two after the hauler shuts off, the cameras go off.
He's had cameras on the Tammy Lynn for 2 years running. Eliason says he was worried at first that the cameras might catch him in a mistake. Unlike Gulf trawlers, who are prohibited from keeping some species aboard, longliners like Eliason bring their bycatch back to port and sell it. But if they catch too much, it can restrict their ability to target halibut in some areas. Eliason's fears did not come to pass.
After the person looked at the videos, they said that they could tell what each species was, and they're not going to have a problem counting them because what they saw is what they're going to get.
The upside is so compelling. Removing human observers from boats of all sizes reduces an element of risk both for you and for the observer. Chris Rilling manages the North Pacific Groundfish and Halibut Observer Program for the National Marine Fisheries Service. He's scraping bottom just to pay for the human observer program. So organizations like the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association in Sitka are finding money on their own. Just this month, they received nearly $500,000 out of a total of $3 million awarded by the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to develop electronic monitoring. The funding will put cameras on 120 boats in Sitka, Homer, Seward, and other ports. All the boats receiving the equipment will be in the 40 to 57.5 foot range. But Rilling doesn't rule out the possibility that electronic monitoring will have applications in bigger classes.
Whether it be accounting for halibut discard on some of the larger vessels, compliance monitoring aspects for retention of species in some of the trawl fisheries, and then again for catch accounting on some of the smaller boats. So there are a variety of ways that we could use the technology, and we're exploring all of those.
The council voted unanimously in Sitka to move forward with a pre-implementation design this year, with the hope that electronic monitoring could be integrated into the management of the small boat fleet by 2018. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Feminist pioneer Gloria Steinem speaks at the University of Alaska Fairbanks tonight. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the human rights activist's visit was instigated by local politics.
University of Alaska Fairbanks Summer Session and Lifelong Learning Program Director Michelle Bartlett reached out to the Ms. Magazine founder last year after a borough assembly member unsuccessfully pushed to get the local food co-op to stop selling the magazine because of a story in support of the right to abortion.
And so I thought, well, I could write a letter to the editor, or we could find somebody to come and address that issue. And I thought, you know, as Jimmy Carter said, why not the best? So we went after Gloria Steinem.
Bartlett says a Fairbanks organizing committee subsequently raised $30,000 from individuals, businesses, and organizations to pay for the Steinem event, which is free to the public. Steinem spoke with reporters Friday morning. She says Alaska was the only U.S. state she'd yet to visit, and that the local story about an attempt to ban Ms. got her attention.
It's not an unusual circumstance. You know, we have been taken out of school libraries in Mount Diablo County in California. You know, we've had this issue, but not in a long time. I think this is maybe the first time in 20 years.
Steinem attributes attempts to do things like ban a magazine empowering women's reproductive rights to a fundamental top-down control model that underlies injustice and violence.
It normalizes the idea that there's going to be a passive and active, subject and object, conquer unconquered. And then we apply that to everything else, you know, to race, to sex, to nationalism.
Steinem points to what she calls supremacy crimes, like mass shootings and murder suicides, as the saddest expression of the male control mindset.
There's no gain except control, except supremacy. And that is the curse of the masculine role.
The 81-year-old Steinem says she takes hope in major change she's seen over her decades as an activist and organizer, adding that humans have great ability to adapt.
Which is the good news in the sense that we survive, and the bad news in the sense that we can be so influenced by culture, by what's around us, we think it's normal. So it happened, and it can unhappen. And it will. It is unhappening.
Gloria Steinem's only Alaska speaking engagement is at UAF, but the 7 p.m. event will be live webcast. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood this summer. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Hannah Colton. This week on AK, Ice Dance. New York dancer and choreographer Jody Sperling had a rare opportunity last year. She was artist in residence aboard the Coast Guard cutter Healy while it was on a research mission in the Arctic. Alone on vast ice floes, she danced while no one watched. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports on her experience and what it's become.
Before she left New York, Sperling was worried about traction.
I had in my head that it would be kind of like an ice skating rink, like slick. And so I got boots that had a real tread on them, but they weren't very high. And so what I discovered the first time I went out is that the snow's kind of deep. And the snow went right over into my feet.
Sperling made do. 12 times during the 6-week mission, she descended the Healy's gangplank and joined the teams of scientists on the ice.
And while they were doing their research in a particular area, I would have, you know, an area where was dedicated for dance, and I could do my research.
In videos she shot of herself during the voyage, you can see Sperling twirling and fluttering on the biggest, barest stage she'll ever find. Last month, though, she was at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History on a more traditional stage.
All right. So I think that where things start to change is just before the Pac-Man.
With five dancers on deck at the Baird Auditorium, she worked on the lighting the afternoon before a performance. It was part of an Arctic festival the museum hosted.
It should go from this more icy look to more of a watery look.
Okay.
Some of the dancers wore extra long silk robes using sticks to control the distant reaches, like an extension of their wingspan. Sperling says it's the silk that's her medium. She projects light and video on it. This isn't her first dance project about natural phenomena. A scientist at MIT was drawn to a piece she did about turbulence. He later introduced her to another scientist who was selecting people for the Healy voyage to the Arctic. The main mission was to follow up on the discovery of a massive plankton bloom. They also wanted artists for public outreach about climate science. Sperling says she was already interested in the Arctic and climate change, but the offer caught her off guard.
When he first invited me, it was a 43-day mission in the Arctic, and at that time my daughter was 2.5, and I literally turned white, as white as snow, when he told me, because I had these two conflicting urges. Which one? I have to go. I want to go. And the other one was, I can't. I can't be away for that long.
She declined at first, then reconsidered. So in May of last year, she flew to Dutch Harbor, caught the Healy, and sailed to the Chukchi Sea off Alaska's northwest coast.
Sometimes we had to break ice, and it would be the most amazing sound when you'd be in the, in the ship, and you'd be going through ice, and you hear, cracking through the ice, and I love that.
After her Arctic experience, Sperling knew she wanted the sounds of sea ice for the performance. That led her to Matthew Burtner, a musician who considers snow and ice his instrument. Sperling quickly figured out she didn't just want to buy a few of his recordings. She was hesitant to ask him, but Burtner says when you play a rare instrument, gigs don't come along often.
So if you make music out of ice and snow and someone calls you up and says, hey, I want to do a piece about ice and snow, would you be interested in collaborating? You'd be like, well, yeah, of course. I mean, this is the best.
Burtner spent part of his childhood in New Ixit, where his parents were teachers. He lives in Virginia now and returns to Alaska annually to collect ice audio. For Sperling's project, Burtner says his composition uses data tracking the change in the Arctic ice extent over 16 years. He plays that as a 16-beat sequence over real-time ice sounds. Burtner says listeners don't necessarily know what they're hearing.
It should work as music. But it has this other kind of secret game hidden inside it. And if you discover it, then it works on another level as well.
Sperling also compresses time in her dance, showing what's normally too slow to see. She says the warming climate is in effect doing the same thing, because as ice thins, it becomes more dynamic, speeding up change across the Arctic. Burtner says that change defines our era and his art.
Like, I think our lifetime is the time of ice melting, that we are in the time of ice melting, and maybe, you know, when I was born there's lots of ice, and maybe when I die there won't be any ice. That somehow it's like a life work.
The Smithsonian show was a bit of a preview. Their work, called Bringing the Arctic Home, premieres in New York this month. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we hear from Matt Williams, who works as a special ed teacher in Anchorage most of the year. Every summer, he and his wife trade their frumpy teacher's clothes for Grundins and head out to Bristol Bay, where they work as commercial fishermen. Williams shares some thoughts on life at fish camp on Nooshogak Bay.
It's an old Russian Orthodox community that it used to be a cannery on that side of of Nishkiak Bay. It's straight across the bay from Dillingham. It's mostly just people from all over the country coming into that seasonal community, and most of us know each other. There is a small basketball court there that we play a lot of basketball. One hoop, lots of bump and knockout. Whenever you set your net out and you start seeing splashes on the cork line, that is something that every fisherman, it just is a thrill. Like, you just get, it's thrilling, especially when you see them from end to end of your net, because your nets are big, long nets. So to see splashes from end to end is like your fisherman's dream, because you're like, they're here, there's fish here, and you know that they're generally being caught in your net, and so it's time to get to work. And that's like what you live for right there. I like removing myself. I like removing myself out in those elements. It just feels, you feel alive. You feel really good about, it's like a great reset from all the amenities that you have in your normal life. Internet and phone or car, all those things, you know, kind of the hustle and bustle of what happens in the city and daily life. To completely break that and go out there for 2 months and just be there. Like, I'll just grow my hair and beard and come back completely unrecognizable to my friends and anybody else, which is really nice to have some anonymity. And then when I go back to Clark Kent mode, it is completely, people from fishing would not recognize me, in my teacher clothes. The fishing life is kind of how I grew up, and the teaching life is something that my wife and I have established, like our lifestyle that we have with that. So being out at fish camp is like going back to how I grew up, and I really like that.
Matt Williams is a commercial fisherman on Nishkiak Bay. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Liz Ruskin, Monica Goki, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Hannah Colton.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Quentin Chandler in Anchor Point, Emily Schwing in Unalaska, Josh Edge and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.